I've heard you speak to curiosity as the thread through this whole thing. And it's what I always say too. It's like, it is an action, right? And it is just this getting curious about the person in front of you. What do they need? And honoring and valuing that as legitimate and not judging it, right? As less than or a problem or inconvenient. And yeah, it really all starts there. If you're a mom with ADHD, navigating the ups and downs of life with a more highly sensitive nervous system, this is your place. Hi, I'm Melissa. In this space, I'm sharing with you the things I've personally learned along my journey as an educator, a parent, an advocate, and as an ADHDer myself. If you're ready to embrace your differences as the unique gifts that they are and start showing up for yourself in new ways that empower you, build self-confidence, and start shifting cycles so you can pass a new way down to your kids, you're in the right spot. I believe that when we get to the root of our symptoms and start healing from the inside out, we not only heal ourselves, but we heal our kids too. Let's talk about it. Hi, friends. Welcome to the Reframing Neurodiversity podcast. I am here with a very special guest today, Lisa Baskin-Wright, who I'm so excited to talk to you today, Lisa. She is a former educator and current IEP coach who navigates the IEP experience through a strength-based lens, a neurodiversity-affirming approach. And this is why I invited her on today, because it's such a needed shift in perspective. Thank you for being here with us, Lisa.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much for reaching out to me and inviting me to be on your podcast. When I found out that you were starting a podcast, I was so excited and I'm just thrilled to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad. I know I've been a fangirl of Lisa's on Instagram and I love all her content. So this is actually the first time we've had the opportunity to chat face to face. So it's exciting.
It is. I've been fangirling on your account as well. And we've done DM voice messages back and forth.
Exactly.
And you're here.
Yay. I have a quote here from you and I'm going to read it to you. It says, one of the best things that can happen at an IEP table is when everyone leaves their ego at the door and gets truly curious about the learner. No one claims to be right. No one diminishes another's perspective. And everyone is trying to consider the child and their point of view and experience in the classroom. It doesn't always happen, but when it does, it's incredibly powerful, and the possibilities for the learner are endless. And that is from Lisa Baskin-Wright on Instagram. And one of the reasons I love to follow you and invited you onto the show, because you have so much goodness to share. And I just love the way you're supporting families and spreading this new message and this shift that's so, so incredibly important in such a beautiful way. So tell me more. I'd love to hear how you define neurodiversity affirming, because as we both know, coming from an education background, even in the special education arena, we've really led with this medical model or deficit-based model for most of our, you know, most of the educational experience. So this shift in getting curious, this shift in looking for strengths is really relatively new, right? And it takes this curiosity. And I'm just curious, how would you define, what is a neurodiversity affirming IEP meeting? What does that look like in your experience?
Yeah, that's a fabulous question. For me, it's just the fundamental belief that every human has equal value and worth.
Yeah.
And when we look through the lens of deficit or deficient, it's like something's broken and we're going to try to fix it. And to me, being neurodivergent or disabled doesn't mean that you're broken.
Right.
I'm not trying to fix you. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get curious and understand how you engage in your world, how you communicate, how you think, and meet you where you are and honor you in your full humanity.
Oh, I love that.
And so for me, what that looks like, kind of my process, is, you know, parents are in different places on this journey. And for us, we started with medical scare. Julia, my daughter, her head size was quite large. Mm-hmm. And she had all these delays and, you know, all these things. And so they started with, we don't know if your child has a brain tumor. We don't know if she's had a stroke. So we had to go through a lot of medical testing. And when you start with cancer and you land at disability and you happen to be naturally really curious about how kids learn, I've always seen my learning with my daughter as just a beautiful opportunity. That doesn't mean there aren't moments that are really hard. That doesn't mean that this is all sunshine and roses, right? Being a disabled human or a neurodivergent human in a world that wasn't designed to embrace difference is hard.
Of course. Yeah.
Right. And so families come to me in kind of different places in that journey. And so I see my role in part to kind of honor where they are and also reassure that their child is fully human. This is their neurotype. We're not here to fix. It's okay to name the hard. And your kid is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the messaging a lot is not that their kid is fantastic. It's not that their kid is great. It's not that their kid is clever or witty or funny, or they don't hear that feedback. And so as I learn more about them, the more I can see and point it out for them. So we kind of together shift the lens.
Yeah.
And then we write, you know, a parent input statement where we really capture who this learner is. What's their temperament? What kinds of things do they enjoy? What are things about them that the school team may not know? And then we go into sort of an overarching theme of what are we really hoping for this learner? And for me, those four things always are autonomy, agency, self-advocacy, and regulation.
Yeah.
So we start there. We get a little bit into the weeds of, you know, where we like goals to focus. So, you know, for example, one of my absolute least favorite goals is something along the lines of that the child will transition from a preferred activity to a non-preferred activity without displaying, you know, problematic or protest behaviors. That goal is not about teaching that learner any skills, the way it is written. That goal is about compliance.
Yes. Tell us about compliance-based goals. What is the problem with that? And why does that impact kids?
Straight compliance, it leads to so many poor outcomes.
Yeah.
So one, it leads to masking. For learners that can comply and are kind of the rules are gospel type kids, it increases anxiety, it increases masking, it actually decreases their ability to be able to learn because they're so hyper-focused on, you know, like doing it right,
right,
and not getting in trouble. So we're creating an experience for that type of temperament that is really heated and taxing, and we're going to push that kid into burnout.
Yeah.
The other piece that's really concerning for me is autistic learners can be more literal in their interpretation of things.
Okay.
So if we sort of set this rule that you're always supposed to blank or you're always supposed to listen to me, we're setting up the stage for them to not listen to their own intuition.
Yes.
So we're creating a scenario where potentially we're making them less safe.
Yes.
Blind compliance is not good.
Right.
It kind of goes against that autonomy and agency piece that we're really wanting these kids to develop. That's what we want for all people to develop, a sense of themselves, a sense of their voice and however they communicate, to be able to be in a situation and think, I don't know that this is for me.
Right.
And have the tools to exit.
Yeah. And be able to trust themselves.
Right. To trust themselves, all the things.
Yeah.
And so I understand that a lot of our systems are compliance driven. So it's not binary.
Right.
But we need to be a bit more nuanced, and we need to be asking ourselves, what skill are we actually trying to teach? So if we go back to that goal of like, you're going to transition throughout your day without, you know, having a problem, the skill is transition.
Okay.
So then how do we rewrite that goal to support whatever this learner may need in order to be able to transition, mm-hmm. so we can teach that particular skill?
Without teaching them to self-abandon and mask to conform to neurotypical expectations.
Exactly. So first of all, I think protest is fantastic. Mm. That's a form of self-advocacy. That's a form of agency. That's a sense of knowing this doesn't work for me and I'm going to communicate it. I say, yes. Fantastic.
It's an act of unmasking.
It's an act of unmasking. I'm all for it.
Yeah.
But I do think being able to transition throughout one's day is a valuable skill.
Right.
So if I was going to write that goal or rewrite that goal, and I was thinking about who this person was, I would be thinking about, well, what kinds of sensory support do they need?
Yeah.
What kinds of executive functioning differences might they have? How am I building that support into the goal, that recognition that this is what this child needs?
Yes.
Depending on the age and the developmental readiness, maybe I write in there that there's some pre-planning, some pre-negotiating mm-hmm. with this learner. Maybe it's providing a model of the exact finished product so they have kind of a template of what they're following so they know when it's done.
Yeah.
Maybe it's that they don't do all the stations and we just follow their timetable because who cares if they do all three and they just do one and they get super stoked about what they're, right? Like
right.
the
yeah.
flexibility built in.
Yep.
Wait time is hugely important. So I always build wait time into an accommodation and write it into goals because there's often processing differences. Yeah. And if we keep interrupting, we mm-hmm. just turn into Charlie Brown's teacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We also need to take into consideration those motor planning differences. So the child very well maybe understood what you said, but it takes an extra beat for them to be able to get their body to do the thing.
Right. Yeah. And honoring that space, that extra minute, that extra beat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So building choice, the choice to dissent, building that all in. And if we are providing this scaffolding, if we are providing a model, or we are providing a visual, or we are allowing for movement, or, you know, whatever that child may need, the likelihood is they will be able to flow through their day more seamlessly because we're meeting their needs and honoring who they are.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we're not trying to control them. So this idea of getting curious. So we set the foundation with the parent input statement, always round it out with a vision statement, and have the family submit it to the team, ideally at least a week ahead of time, so that we're sort of reframing who this child is.
I love this. And I've heard you speak to curiosity as the thread through this whole thing. And it's what I always say too. It's like, it is an action, right? And it is just this getting curious about the person in front of you. What do they need? And honoring and valuing that as legitimate and not judging it, right, as less than or a problem or inconvenient. And yeah, it really all starts there.
I do similar work with the actual IEP. So I will go through it. I've learned over time that you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So IEPs are very systematic. We get present levels. We establish baselines. We look at those, you know, quote unquote, areas of concern. We generate a goal to figure out what's sort of reasonable to achieve within a year's time. If we ignore the baseline capture, or we don't correct the baseline capture, and we just say this goal is awful and we throw it out without providing more information or reframing, we are going to hit resistance during those meetings every single time. And they're going to say, this is the data that we have, right?
Yeah.
So trying to stay within sort of the wheelhouse of the area they're looking at, shifting language in the goal. So we have to get curious about who this particular learner is and where they are in their development.
Yeah. So tell me, have you in your experience seen when you shift to this more strength-based, neurodiversity-affirming perspective, What types of impact have you seen in the students, the families you work with, when you do achieve that for them?
There's more peace. There's better communication among the team.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that like I can solve everybody's problems. I wish I had a few, you know, magic tricks up my sleeve. But in many ways, I think the biggest shift is helping families reframe how they're thinking about their learner, because it informs how they parent.
Yes.
It informs which kind of battles they pick at an IEP table. It informs how they engage in that relationship with the team. You know, the idea of presuming competence with the learner themselves can't be overstated how important that is.
Right.
But we also need to presume competence of the team.
Mm.
We need to assume, as hard as it is, and I say this as somebody who had a really rocky road, we have to assume the intention, the curiosity, the goodness is there. And that perhaps it's lack of awareness, perhaps it's a really bad habit, perhaps it's a fear of reflection. That doesn't mean there aren't bad apples out there, so to speak, and that there can't be really, really tough situations, because there are. I'm not a Pollyanna. I've sat in enough meetings to know, like, ooh, this nut's going to be tough to crack.
Yeah.
But when we enter a space presuming competence of the team and honoring their perspective, there's more willingness to shift.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's two things I'm hearing that I think is making this successful, and tell me if you agree. So one, I think it's this art of communicating and how you, one, you're starting with the parent input statement, right? Where you're reframing this for not just for the teacher, but I'm sure this process, I would imagine, would be a reframe for the family as well. Like, let's look at this child in truth. Let's look at what they do well. And as we know, when we see them in this way, it gives the child permission to see themselves in this way, right? But that communication piece of setting the tone before you even go into the team, I feel like is probably a game changer, because these meetings, let's be honest, can be combative. It's heated. There are kids. We're going to be emotional. But when we can shift and also presume, like you said, everyone at the table is really wanting to do their best, but maybe doesn't have access to all the information, and respecting some of the things that are in place, but then like, let's shift and let's educate in a kind way. I just hear you saying the way that you're approaching this, not just with the team, but with the family, is going to have this impact on the child, and what actually translates to their experience, it's going to be so much greater than when we go in there all in our corners, you know, with our egos leading the way of we're right and this is my way and just holding on so tightly. So I think it's brilliant. This approach is really what's going to translate to impacting the kid, is what I hear.
Yeah. And, you know, I know in my own experience, you know, there were several sort of pain points along the way that lifted up for me. And one of them speaks to this idea of vulnerability and exposing yourself, is that in kind of a traditional IEP process, you as the parent are having to be really exposed and vulnerable. Yeah. And you're having to share all of this information about your child, about yourself,
mm-hmm.
right? They take family history. They want to know all the things. You're exposing your decisions as a parent. It's very, very exposing with people you don't necessarily trust.
Right.
Good so point. It's right. It's kind of against intuition to say, actually the kind of more you expose, the more you give the team permission, but it's sort of how you do it, right? It's nuanced. Yeah. And so for me, some of the guidance I give parents is, it's okay to say to a team, I'm learning too.
Hmm.
You're almost modeling that.
What you want from them.
Right, for them. You're kind of modeling this journey of, gosh, in hindsight, I cringe at some of the decisions I made when I didn't have the information I have now.
Yes.
But now that I have some of this information, it's really important that I'm sharing my personal kind of transformation as a parent and sharing with you how that's made an impact in our home and giving you permission to reframe your own perspective.
Yes. Like modeling that we can be lifelong learners gives them almost permission to be like, okay, I don't have to be perfect and have it all figured out. And I think that's full circle, even when we communicate with our kids and we mess up, like, right? Like, I'm still learning. I'm still figuring it out. It's that vulnerability piece that allows for connection, which I'm hearing you like that applies to everyone at the IEP table and the child in the classroom feeling safe enough to self-advocate, feeling safe enough to share what's going on. It's all this. Being vulnerable is really the first step. Do you feel that? That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. And when we are asking students to learn, whether they're neurodivergent or not, we're asking them to be incredibly vulnerable because doing something you don't know how to do yet is very exposing.
Yeah.
So we are much more willing as humans to try and expose ourselves in ways that, you know, make us vulnerable if we feel safe and connected. Yeah. To whoever that adult is that's in the room. And right. So when we focus on creating a program that sort of opens the doors for the adults to really engage with this learner in ways that are meaningful, and those relationships can blossom, that feels like a win and a success for the team. And they want more of that. And I think that in order for somebody to be able to be vulnerable, there has to be safety and trust. Yes. And it is a little chicken egg. Yes. And so there's a bit of a leap of faith, right? Because yeah. opening ourselves up, sharing that we're all learners, setting the tone that we're all here to learn, and that I bring value as a parent, I bring value and expertise and perspective to this meeting that is right. necessary for us to create a meaningful program for my child. Yes. This is not just traditional teaching of like, you talk, I take notes and listen, right? A lot of families feel very overwhelmed by the process. They don't necessarily track all the detail and minutiae of what's happening. Even if something doesn't sit right, they don't feel empowered to say, gosh, I don't know that I fully understood what you just said, but it doesn't make sense to me, or it feels counterintuitive. Can we explore this a little more? Most families kind of go one of two ways. They either shrink and get quiet and say, okay, or they get mad.
Yeah. Right.
And there's more of a conflict. And it doesn't, we don't have to live in the binary. We can be in the middle and, you know, being more affirming, being more focused on building kind of positive relationships do have conflict. There is dissent. In a positive, healthy relationship, we are able to say to one another, gosh, I don't think we're seeing eye to eye on this. Can we talk it through?
Yes. And shifting that the parent, I think the old way was that, you know, the professionals or the employees of the school were the ones running the show, and the parent was just there to learn from them, and kind of shifting that to be a more equal give and take of, no, parents are educated. Parents know their kid, and what they have to contribute is valid and valuable and should be considered as well. And kind of that's part of the shift, don't you think, in the dialogue?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And not to the point of, I know everything and you as a school know nothing, but I add value to this space.
Yes.
You know, this question comes up a lot with, you know, some teams are better than others. It varies literally from school to school. I'm not even going to say from district to district or state to state. Like, it really is like team to team.
Person to person.
Person to person. Kind of the habits of the school in terms of sharing information ahead of time.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So there's some districts, some teams that are like, yes, let's send this information ahead of time. Let's all have an opportunity to collect our thoughts, collect our questions, have some dialogue ahead of time so that when we enter the space of the IEP meeting itself, we're ready to like hit the road and have this, you know, great productive conversation. There are other teams that are like, no, we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's predetermination. I'm using air quotes for those who can't see me, right? Like, you know, and it is a little bit of a tightrope to walk, because predetermination is not okay. And a lot of teams do that.
So what advice do you give to parents who are in that situation where you're kind of up against, before you even begin, the opportunity to collaborate in the way you would like?
My advice to them is to send an email ahead of time. So let's pretend it's a Friday. You haven't gotten any information. Your meeting is Monday morning. Send out an email on the Friday afternoon saying, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us on Monday morning. Really looking forward to having a collaborative conversation to discuss, you know, our child's program. Because we don't have access to the same information as the rest of the team, this is most likely going to just be an information gathering conversation. And we very well may need to have a part two where we can actually make decisions.
Oh, that's so smart. I love that.
So you're telling them.
Yeah.
You know, you can even do it prior to that. Mm-hmm. You know, if we are unable to get draft copies of your reports or a draft copy of the IEP by Friday before our Monday meeting, then, because sometimes that lights a fire where teams are like, we don't have time to do a part two. Let's just give the squeaky wheel what they're asking for.
Right.
And then great. Then you,
yeah,
you
perfect. Got it. It worked. Yeah.
It exactly. worked. And in other situations, if they're really like, we just don't do that here, and sorry, no can do, you yeah. say, no problem. But you know, we're probably not going to feel comfortable making decisions during the space of the meeting. We're going to need some time. You know, different states have different regulations around this. So like here in California, IEPs don't go into effect until they're signed, but there's a whole lot of states in the union where that's not the case.
Interesting.
There's a window of time. It could be 10 days. It could be 14 days where if you don't file for due process, you don't file the complaint to start the paperwork, that IEP is going into effect that time frame. So the dance varies depending on where you live. But the strategy of we can't make any decisions if I don't have equal access to information.
Yeah.
I can't meaningfully participate, because a parent's right to be an equal participant in the IEP process is federally protected.
Mm.
And if you don't have access to the same information as everybody else, you can't meaningfully participate.
That's great information for parents to have. And is the parent input statement, that is something they're legally entitled to provide as well, correct?
Oh, absolutely. That's a way to provide input. So it doesn't matter where you are in the country, it might be called different things, but there is always a section in an IEP where they're capturing the strengths of the student and they're capturing parental concerns.
Okay.
Typically the way it works, some districts are better than others. I want to give credit where credit's due, where they try to glean this information ahead of the meeting. But far too often, what it really looks like is you come into the space, whether it's virtual or in person. Oh, great. Thank you so much for coming today. Let's start. Tell us a little bit about Lisa's strengths. And so then parents kind of gush and, you know, and then it's, do you have any concerns today? And then parents either freeze or, you know, they say all their concerns and the team says, oh, thank you. And sometimes they round robin and teachers or service providers will share their perspectives on strengths or their perspectives on concerns. Obviously varies from team to team, but it's more procedural where they, oh, great. Thank you, Melissa, so much for telling us. Check. Mm-hmm. Instead of, I've set the tone for you ahead of time.
Right.
Of, this is where I need your attention focused, and this is how we are framing my child.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I expect when I come into this space that you're holding this information like paramount. It's a little bit of a way to kind of be a coxswain on the crew boat, right? Like I'm guiding you a little bit and being your North Star of this is where we're going.
Yeah. You're setting the tone.
You are setting the tone.
Yeah. Yeah. So are there specific goals, environments that would really support the neurodivergent child in the classroom that are kind of go-tos that parents can know, okay, this is really going to help my kid?
Sure. So unrestricted access to sensory support is a must.
Not and earning it. If you're good, then you get your fidget.
Yeah. No.
And good was in air quotes.
Right. Yes. Parallel to that is honoring all communication. So this idea that spoken language is superior
Yeah.
needs to be dispelled.
Yes.
So unrestricted access to sensory support, providing access to robust communication. There's way too much stigma, like, oh, they have some spoken language. They don't need AAC.
And what's AAC?
Oh, AAC, alternative and assistive communication.
Okay.
And so that can mean many different things. It can mean, you know, an actual like tablet or device, like high tech. Mm-hmm. It can be texting. It can be writing it down. It could be pointing to a visual, right? Anything that sort of assists or augments communication.
Okay.
But I see this a lot for Gestalt processors in the earlier stages of natural language acquisition, where they have spoken language, but it's predominantly scripting, is that the team resists providing that higher tech assistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because quote unquote, the child talks. And that's for learners who, right? And then there's this rub in the non-speaking community, or for learners who are non-speaking, of, well, they're not ready, which is nonsense.
Yeah.
There's no prerequisite to providing access to robust communication. So kind of pushing that thread.
Yeah. That unrestricted access is actually what's equitable for all.
Unrestricted access is equitable for all, allowing for movement.
Mm-hmm.
This whole idea that a learner has to sit in their spot or sit at the table or, right? So alternative ways of engaging. I mean, obviously, we want all the children to be safe, right? Yeah. You know, but recognizing that it's okay to stand at circle and be on your tiptoes or whatever you need to do, move a little bit, or be turned away or in the beanbag chair or whatever, right? You can stand and do your work and be just as competent, if not more so, because you're getting the proprioceptive input that you need.
Yes. And can you tell us what's proprioceptive input?
Proprioceptive is like deep pressure. Mm-hmm. So there's certain like positions that a body can be in where you're getting kind of more input into your body. So like laying on your tummy provides more input into the body than like just sitting on your bottom, crisscross applesauce, which, oh my gosh, can we please
stop doing? Stop saying right? crisscross. Yeah. How long have we been saying that?
All the things.
Yeah.
Really shifting to providing choice.
Yeah.
Respecting autonomy. Using declarative language. Not engaging in a power struggle over nothing.
With a child.
Right. Let the child win.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. If you could leave one word of wisdom about what do we need to do as parents, as educators, as just people in the world, what's the mindset shift that needs to happen around our neurodivergent learners?
I think we need to move away from trying to control and move away from fear. And I think we need to move towards curiosity, recognizing the inherent value in all humans, always presuming competence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
I think we try too hard to control and change. And I think that that's born out of fear of difference.
Absolutely.
And I think we need to move away from fear and just celebrate difference, recognize value, be curious.
Yeah. That it's needed. We actually need us all to be different. We all have different gifts, different strengths for a reason, because that's our lane to contribute, is the way I see it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you for being here. I would love for you to share with the listeners, how can people get in touch with you? I know you have amazing resources. How can they connect?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll start by saying thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure and so fun to
I know. It is so fun to finally talk.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, the best way to get a hold of me is on Instagram. My handle is at Lisa Baskin Wright. I do have some free resources on my page. I have one of the ways to kind of open up the lines of communication is submitting what's called an All About Me page for your learner. So I have a free template. I also have a neurodiversity affirming resource list that Melissa is on.
Oh, yay.
but there's links to you know, speech language pathologists, AAC users and professionals who specialize in AAC, podcasts, books, children's books, there's all OTs, physical therapists. So there's all kinds of affirming providers with hyperlinks to their pages. I do work with clients one-on-one. I do virtually attend meetings. And in that case, you know, I can help write those parent input statements. I can help revise those goals. I can join you and answer any question at any time. You kind of got me in your back pocket, but I have to keep that number somewhat limited because there's only one of me.
Yes, a lot goes into that. Oh my goodness. So many wonderful things that you offer this community. Thank you, Lisa, for being here. It was such an honor and a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me. If you liked this podcast, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and share it with a friend who might need it. And if you're curious to discover where you're at in your nervous system and would like tools to support yourself in whatever state you're in so you can create more safety in your body to feel more grounded and connected to yourself, I've created a free quiz that allows you to discover your current state right now and receive a practice with your results for immediate support. Check out the show notes to grab it. Can't wait to chat with you next time.